This Nobel Peace Prize awarded episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Head to Squarespace.com/Duncan for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. It's time for you to comb the lion's mane. That means make a beautiful website using the top website creation service in the universe, Squarespace.com. Greetings to you, Vornogs of the Seventh Fold. It is I, Migstarg, and you're listening to the Migstar Mifling Swarm Cluster Pulse. All hail the Great Queen. I am recording this from within my chrysalis right now. I recently melted down and went into a chrysalis phase. I'm currently a bubbling goo inside a beautiful green chrysalis hanging from a Vanstrock tree. If you saw me right now, you'd see there's no gills, no wings, my pinchers are gone, my eyes are gone, my seven sacks of reproduction have liquefied completely. My pulsation membrane is gone. I'm just goo and ooze and bubbling goo and ooze. I prepared for this cycle for seven moons of Nador, but I never realized what it's like to be inside the chrysalis. To quote Orson Vreach, we must tend to the part of the hive that we hum upon. We must remember the dance of the Omnivrex, who vibrated this. Offer ambrosial nectar to your hivelings as you would yourself. And if you are robbing yourself of ambrosial nectar by spraying yourself with acid, then how can you possibly offer ambrosial nectar to other quadrants of the hive? And if you ask me, the only hope for the hive is the sharing of ambrosial nectar. We don't have to use the Matrix of Soldar to spread fear pheromones. We can use the Matrix of Soldar to share ambrosial nectar. And if we do that, I believe the entire hive itself may enter a chrysalis phase and go into a metamorphic process that transforms itself into a hive more beautiful than any of us could ever imagine. And I understand some of us are spraying fear pheromones because it's frightening to watch the tunnels and egg chambers of our former generations melting before our very eyes. But perhaps this melting is not, as some say, the end of the hive, but the beginning of a new hive. These are the things that occur to us as we liquefy within our chrysalis. That being said, I did roll in the petals of a waffler flower prior to my liquefaction, so to be honest, I am a little buzzed right now. We got a great podcast for you today. We're going to jump right into it, but first, some quick business. Dad joke. Unforgivable dad joke. This episode of the DTFH, which has received a waterfall of accolades from some of the top intellectual institutes around the planet, has been made possible by Squarespace.com. Head over to Squarespace.com/Duncan for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace, it lets you create a beautiful website where you can turn your cool idea into a new website, you can showcase your work, blog or publish content, announce an upcoming event or special project, and just about anything you can imagine, including creating personalized websites for your family, your friends, your dogs of past, and even dogs of the future. Check it out. AmericanDogCloning.com. It's available. And right now, if you go to Squarespace and use offer code Duncan, you can get 10% off of that domain, which no doubt will make you $10 trillion. Squarespace, it lets you build websites by giving you beautiful templates created by world-class designer. It's got powerful e-commerce functionality, lets you sell anything online. And what service is more in demand in these dog-loving times than dog cloning? It's embarrassing when somebody comes over to your house and looks at your dog and realizes that you haven't cloned it yet. Don't be that person in your neighborhood that doesn't have at least three identical duplicates of your best friend. Dogcloning.com. You can make it over at Squarespace.com. You can make it yourself and you can make it stand out. It's It's time for you to start that new business. Do it with Squarespace.com. It's time for you to get those dogs cloned, baby. And before you do it, head to squarespace.com/Duncan for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. DuncanTrussell.com is a Squarespace website. I use it every time I upload an episode of the DTFH, and I love them. Thanks, Squarespace. Would you like to shove your face deeper into the squirting fountain of glory that is the DTFH? Head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe, and you're going to get instant access to interviews that have yet to be put out on the main feed. Not only that, but once a month, you will have access to earth-shattering, hour-long monologues that don't ever make it on the main feed. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to hear the Sermon on the Mount being spoken by a hybrid of Steve-O and a chain-smoking lesbian truck driver? Then head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. Become my patron. Force me to kiss your boot. Force me to bow before you as you strut across our digital courtyard in the great palace of the DTFH. A tremendous thank you to those of you who continue to use our Amazon link. If you ever feel like buying any of the stuff we talk about on the podcast, or if you ever feel like buying things that you think about during the podcast, then all you got to do is go to Amazon.com via the link, which is located at DuncanTrussell.com. Just scroll down and there's an Amazon thing there, and you click on any of that stuff and buy anything on Amazon, and Amazon gives us a very small percentage of that, and it costs you nothing. Finally, we got a shop with t-shirts and posters and some swag located at DuncanTrussell.com. A few weeks ago, I was skipping through the internet and I came upon the story of Taryn Southern. She's a very talented human being who recently used artificial intelligence to compose the music of an amazing album that's going to be coming out real soon. Not only does she make some beautiful music, but she also has created some awesome YouTube videos that explore some of my favorite topics like life extension, robotics, and of course, artificial intelligence. And now she's here with us today. Everybody, please send out a radiant beam of pure pyroclastic love energy through the undulating matrix, the mycelial web of metaphysical energy that connects all of us so that it goes rolling down the tubes and rains sweet joy upon today's brilliant guest, Taryn Southern. Taryn, welcome to the DTFH. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Man, I am so excited. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. I discovered you through just a random sort of YouTube. Somehow I landed on one of your beautiful music videos where you are singing a song that an artificial intelligence created.
Composed, yeah.
Composed.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk to you about that. How much AI is in there? And how much Taryn is in there?
So I've written a handful of songs and released them using AI. So it depends on the song we're talking about. I assume you're talking about Break Free?
That's right.
Okay, Break Free. So Break Free was composed with a software called Amper. And the way I compare the process of making music on my own with making music with AI is I take more of a directorial or editorial approach.
Sure.
So the AI is spitting out all of the instrumentation, the stems of the instruments. I'm merely providing it with direction.
Gotcha.
Like BPM, tone, style, instrumentation. And then I can iterate as many times as I want until I get something I'm happy with. And then I arrange that into a pop song. I also wrote the lyrics and the vocal melodies. So that's me.
Which came first, the lyrics or the melody? Or the song?
The song came first.
So the song inspires the lyrics.
That's right.
So there's this sort of communion happening between the music the AI has generated and your consciousness, and those two are blending together to produce a song.
And it's kind of the perfect communion because I can't produce tracks.
What do you mean?
I've never been able to produce my own music. So it was funny when I came in here and you said, you probably know so much about music. And I'm like, well, I always wished that I could just create music using only my voice and record vocal cords as each instrument and then tell the software, you know, turn this into the flute or the violin, turn this into the chord, because I don't understand music composition.
Why?
Just never was taught. Never was taught. Took it on as a hobby. Really love writing songs, but there's a disconnect between myself and the process of learning
how to make music.
I suppose part of it is just I didn't start making music until after college, so I was already working. It's really hard to pick up a hobby with Pro Tools or Logic.
Yes.
You know,
sure.
And not having anyone to teach me, I can do very basic stuff in Logic.
Whoa.
Very basic. So using the AI is so helpful because I basically get all this inspirational source material.
Yeah.
I can pick what I like, dump everything else, and create something that I find inspiring.
Wow. So you have this beautiful voice. And
thank you.
I've assumed because you have such a beautiful voice, a lot of times people who are able to sing really well, they understand, intuitively, they understand music. And so they picking up an instrument is easier for them.
I'm devastated I can't play an instrument.
Oh, I love this. This is great because this is something that I've just been discovering and I've been spending a lot of time thinking about it, which is that I am really interested right now in there's probably a better term for it, but it's like imprinting of powerful people in our lives onto us and then the sort of amnesia that happens where you forget that you've been imprinted. Mm. So certain behavior patterns that maybe aren't that great that come from a powerful force in our lives when we were kids. Like my dog Fox, I did this once, I don't do it anymore, but I took my belt off and I lifted the belt up. You know, I don't even know why I did it, but he saw me lift the belt up and he flinched like he's going to hit me with a belt. And then I realized, oh fuck, that dog has been beaten by a belt. It's a rescue dog. Mm. And so the flinch, I could tell a little bit about the dog from the flinch, right? Yep. And so then I've been thinking like, oh, what am I flinching at? You know, what things do I flinch?
In life.
In life.
Yeah.
And one of those things for sure has been the learning of music, as in the actual scales and notes and playing music. And the reason, and I've realized like, wait, why is that? Like, I know how to do Photoshop. I know how to do Logic. I know how to edit. I know how to do this and that and this and that. I can make rice. But wait, somehow music, there's this weird boundary between me and learning the music. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, oh, I bet somebody got in my head when I was young. Because I started thinking like, shit, I kind of think of musicians as X-Men. Do you know what I'm saying, Tara?
Oh, I do. But could it also be that the language of music, the language in which music is taught, just doesn't work with your communication interface? You know, like even just with piano, I did play piano a bit growing up.
Okay.
And there were two schools of thought in piano. It was like learn by sheet music or learn by ear and chord structure. And
okay.
I learned by the first. So I can actually play the piano with a piece of sheet music in front of me.
I've heard
but
that.
I have no idea what chord structures mean. And when people start trying to teach me, it almost feels like a brain scramble because I learned through this other entry point. Similarly, using some of these AI programs like Watson or Google Magenta, where I'm actually coding and there's a little bit more technical expertise required, I have a new entry point into the language of music that I didn't have before vis-a-vis code. That seems to make more sense to me. So I just wonder, maybe you just haven't figured out you haven't put a nail on the actual communication of the teaching of music that works with your brain.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And it's specifically the teaching part, which is that, you know, there's a verse in the Bible. I don't know which part of the Bible. I think it's the New Testament. You can tell the Son. You can tell the Father by the Son, right? And so you could kind of tell the student by the teacher, right? And that thing that you're talking about there, it seems like many of us got exposed to like some weird teachers or something. and began to like
100%.
100%, right?
And it's the same reason why certain kids can understand calculus right away and others can't, but then with the right teacher that provides a new entry point into that. It's
yeah.
like, bam, it all makes sense. The world opens up. The universe suddenly makes sense.
Exactly. And that is what I wanted to talk to you about in terms of AI, which is that if we can tell the father by the son, and we are building an AI right now, and we are all sort of communally teaching this emergent technology how to be a thing, do you think we can predict, based on human personality, the personality of the incoming superintelligence that's about to emerge into the world?
That's a really good, juicy question that I am not... I don't feel I am suitable to answer, but... I mean, just even off of even looking at the AI that I've been working with in music, I can tell a lot about the engineers that built the AI based on how they think about music structure, how they think about style, how they think about tone.
Wow.
And I don't even have to understand chord structure to just basically derive certain patterns from the output of various categories that they prescribe to music.
Okay, gotcha.
So I would imagine that I could apply that same sort of script to other forms of AI and say that, yes, you could certainly determine certain things about the engineers who set up the parameters, so to speak. The parameters of the world. They're setting the rules, and the AI is kind of playing within that field. But if you're working with an AI that's simply doing massive pattern analysis on a tremendous amount of data, you really have no... I don't think you have any way of knowing what that AI is going to predict or come up with. Because humans, we're just not very good at predictive data analysis on our own.
No, we're not. Huh?
No.
I mean, we're okay at it, but if we were...
Intuitively.
Intuitively.
But a lot of times we don't understand the mechanisms underneath the car hood, so to speak, that
right.
are determining these choices that we make.
Okay, I want to talk about that. So understanding the mechanisms under the car hood related to decision making. How much of that do you think is...
I love thinking about this stuff, by the way.
Me too.
It's... we are very advanced AIs.
Well, that's right. Yes, definitely. This is that... There's a... You know the philosopher Gurdjieff? You ever heard of him? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he said most people are just spiritual machines, that most people imagine they have some autonomy, but everything they do is just a series of learned behavior patterns, and there really isn't much freedom in there at all. And so he gives a lot of examples. One of the best ones is the next time you buy something, just watch the way you buy something, and you realize you've gone into like buy something mode, the way you take your card out, the way that you look at the cashier, the way that you swipe the card, the way that you say thank you. This is not, you're not doing generally novel buying methods when you buy stuff. You might have variants. Like, you might be especially fake kind to them when you're buying something. Or perhaps you feel really good and you might really look them in the eye and be like, thank you so much. I hope you're having a great day. But in general, it's all variants of the exact same series of motions and things that you say. And so his point is like, okay, well, we've got that. Where else is that located?
And everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, I think.
Do you think there's any autonomy in humans, or do you really think that we're just sort of a mathematical equation?
It's really not fun to think of ourselves as mathematical equations, so I prefer to tell myself the story that we have some level of free will. Most of my really, really smart mathematician friends would side with the philosopher that you were just quoting, saying that there is no free will, and they're smart, and I trust them. So... But I don't know. If we're thinking about our decisions, our behaviors as a product of our collective experiences, and sort of our brains are pattern matching off of our past experiences and choosing the best route. While you could argue that that doesn't look like a lot of free will, if you were to add a new experience into the equation, something that's really random, something that kind of adds chaos into the mix, a differential, so to speak, then all of a sudden you kind of upset the system, and then you could create a new sort of behavior. So I suppose the mathematician people would maybe argue that that's still not free will, but I don't know, it creates some more fun.
This is beautiful. As an individual. I love it. There's so many stories in Zen of a student being with a teacher, and the teacher will do something outrageous, just something that doesn't make any sense at all. In fact, one of the methods in Zen is the koan. You know about the koan? So the koan is like the one you always hear is, what's the sound of one hand clapping?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of, it's a question that just doesn't make sense. There's many different versions of them. There's a lot of koans. So you're sitting there meditating day after day after day. And this teacher, well, every few days you go into a room with a Roshi who asks you this impossible to answer question while you've been in a kind of, I guess you could say, sensory deprivation experience. You're just sitting still staring at a wall. And somewhere in there, the question basically cracks your code. What did you call it? A differential?
I called it a differential.
Yeah.
I don't know that I made any sense, but...
Yeah, that's pretty cool. A differential, a chaos engine, a kind of like random number generator
random
within
generator.
The code. Just blap. And then apparently...
It throws the whole AI out of whack.
It throws the AI out of whack. And then what happens, what emerges out of you, apparently, is some form of awakening. It creates a kind of like awakening, which is... I guess that would be when the... AI gains true sentience, but it's for a human.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, people are so worried about AI gaining sentience. I'm like, why aren't we more concerned about humans gaining sentience?
I know.
I'm way more scared of people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for sure. Isn't that interesting? Because people are speciesists, right? We are so caught up in ourselves that we are like looking at like AI and wasps. And, you know, and we're like, it's bad. That's bad. It's potentially bad. It's going to sting us. It's going to get us.
Yep.
Meanwhile, I mean, our country, it's been at war 93% of its history. Did you know that?
That's crazy.
93% of the history of the United States, we've been at war. It's been 20 or something like 25 years where there's been peace in this country, in the entire history of the country. And so we are looking at the AI. Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? And we look at the AI and we're like, oh, what's
this? Terrifying.
Right. But in a way, if the concept is that the programmer imprints itself on the programming, perhaps there is a good reason to be terrified.
Yeah, that's true. Again, it just depends on what type of AI it is and how it's learning and iterating and where it's getting the data and how the data is being tagged and categorized. I think that those are the things that people... should be talking about.
Well, let's go deeper into that. And specifically, like, I guess you could say disruptive technology.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be someone who is not only deeply aware of what's happening in technology in the world. It seems like you gravitate towards some pretty controversial disruptive technologies and are exploring them with a really open mind. But also simultaneously, you became famous because of because you're talented and brilliant and funny, but the medium that you've used for that is a new medium.
Mm-hmm.
They call it new media, right?
Right.
So I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the blind spot right now in humanity? What is the thing that we're not seeing, or most of us aren't seeing, the sort of like meteor out there zinging towards the earth that hasn't been picked up by the satellites? Mm-hmm. What's the meteor technologically that's coming from within us that could produce the most disruption over the next few decades?
Oh, that's such a fun question. My boyfriend thinks about this a lot, and he calls it horseshit problems.
Mm.
Have you ever heard this term?
No.
So back in the early 1900s, apparently people in the cities, primarily New York City, were terrified about the sicknesses that were propagating because of horse shit. Like, there was so much horse poo everywhere. It was getting into the water, sinking the tanks, and people were dying, and little kids were dying. And this was a huge, huge problem.
Whoa.
And then, of course, the car was born, And no one could have predicted that the car would have suddenly solved the horseshit problem.
Right.
But everyone was really stressed about this thing that inevitably became irrelevant because of technology.
Cool.
But we couldn't have predicted it.
That's fucking cool.
Isn't that cool? So, like, it's funny in some ways, some of the really, really big problems that are causing a lot of angst, even within the scientific community, may be solved within 5 to 10 years. May not be the things that actually determine whether or not we make it as a species. For instance, climate change, right?
Right.
We don't know. Could scientists in the next, 10, 15 years figure out how to convert carbon in a way that, solves this whole crisis for us? This is a long-winded way of saying, like, I have no idea what our blind spot could be. Okay, you know what? Actually, no. I will give you an answer.
Thank you.
I will give you something. I do think that the terror over AI and progressive tech in general is unfounded. And I do think that I think we need it to survive. So I actually think the thing that could hold us back the most is legislation and public attitudes and beliefs towards technology and wanting to kind of rein it in. Because I just think we're such a mess that if we don't figure out how to allow these other, I think we need to have a more science-friendly, tech-friendly environment to allow these technologies to proliferate and solve problems.
Wow. Okay, so the blind spot is probably not so much going to be related to some disruptive technology as much as a disruptive, like, mode of being for a country or the planet.
I'd love to see people in general just embracing adaptability as more of a lens at which to look at everything in their life. I mean, they're going to have to. Like, everything from jobs, we know that there's going to be a huge, huge, huge issue with that in the coming years. And I don't think we have done a good job of educating kids, particularly in the U.S., to be flexible and adaptable. They're not taught that way. They're not taught to think that way.
No.
And so it's less about training people into certain positions and more about establishing a certain attitude towards life that Americans, who are very set, I think, in 9-to-5 and a certain way of life, are going to have a really tough time transitioning.
Yeah, and you say we know this massive unemployment is about to hit, but I don't think we do know. I think you know, but I don't think most people are...
Well, I don't really know. I suppose I'm just... What I'm seeing come out the pipeline is insane. I just can't imagine that it doesn't somehow take over a lot of these positions.
Well, humans are definitely terrible at trend analysis, but we're not, some people are pretty good at it because there's a lot of money in it. Like, and also if you're going to invent something, you need to invent something based on technology that doesn't even exist yet. So you have to sort of predict what kind of chips are going to be in existence in 2 years, so that by the time you get through product development, you can use those chips, right?
Right.
So we're pretty good at it. And some of those people are predicting something like a 45% unemployment rate based on...
I believe it.
AI.
I believe it. The more I've taken a deep dive into some of these programs, I'm like, half the professions that were some of the best professions you could go into when I was in college are going to be out of jobs in 5 to 10 years.
Yes. And everybody, and so you say this to some people and their response is, that's true, but we're going to need robot repair people, or we're going to need, like, coders who can work on the code, or new jobs are going to emerge as these old jobs die out. And I don't agree. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that's a pretty... naive fantasy, if you ask me, which is just, we're talking about efficiency here, and humans just aren't very efficient when it comes to doing stuff, and they're expensive, and they get sick, and they break down, and they get pregnant, and they go on strike, and they want more, and capitalism is a thing that is weirdly capitalism is the pressure that is creating the AI. Like, it's like
the pressure cooker.
It's the pressure cooker that's building the AI, because for a employer, for anyone who has workers, if for anyone who wants to profit off the backs of workers, there's two things that are very appealing to someone who has zero ethics. Two things. Slavery and AI. Like, what's better than that? You know, like, in AI, is way better than slavery, because you don't have to feed the AI. You don't have to house the AI, you know? So,
yeah.
Wouldn't you say that we're kind of on
There's compounded returns with AI that you don't get with humans, for sure. If you're going to invest $10,000 into building AI software or $10,000 into the education of one human, which one's going to give you the better return?
There you go.
It's going to take that human 16 years. Wait, no, sorry. What, 26 years to get their PhD, or 22 to get their bachelor's?
Yeah.
And then they got to go train and do something else because technology disrupts it?
Exactly.
No, I mean, I agree with you that the return bucket on digital intelligence is, the delta is so massive that we're absolutely going to see a huge shift where there are going to be a tremendous people without jobs. I do also believe that there will be new careers that we can't even fathom. I mean, I've come up with a few of my own since working with AI.
What do you got?
Well, I mean, let's see, I've never even articulated this, but I'll do my best. Because I'm working with digital music in a form that I've never worked with it before, and I also have a little bit of background in VR and AR, and I've been getting into haptics. What I see as being like the new role of the musician in 5 to 10 years is that of an experiential musician that can essentially pair music with haptic technology, touch, visuals to create these auditory experiences for people.
Wow.
And it's almost like a musical director of the future.
Wow.
And I know that, I mean, I just feel it in every part of my body that this is going to be a thing and that this is going to elevate music to a new level, and there are going to be very specific people that will be very, very good at this.
Wow.
But we can't really comprehend that because we just don't really have it. We sort of do. If you go to Burning Man and you sit in a dome, you can kind of get like a cool musical / visual haptic experience, but that's not scalable and readily available right now.
Right.
But it will be once we have the AR and our phones and like all these other things. It's just, I do see things popping up that we can't anticipate. I also think, at least I hope, that with AI taking care of a lot of the, I'll call it the BS crap of life that we don't like taking care of.
Sure.
That we can spend more time on like higher forms of cognition, higher creativity, empathy. I mean, we have a huge mental health problem. We need more really trained, skilled therapists and coaches and like people helping other people, because that's what people do best. And robots aren't so good at that. They don't have those skills.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I mean, I think we'll see a massive increase in mental health facilitation. At least I hope. Robots can't do that.
AI can't do that?
I mean, it can diagnose certain mental health problems, but in terms of actually working with a human, humans also just don't want that from a robot. We prefer other humans. So I think having that kind of facilitation could be, we see a massive increase in those people. Maybe.
Okay, cool.
Maybe, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'm throwing things out, but.
Well, I think humans are, you know, this is one of the things I love about the Hare Krishnas is one of the things Prabhupada said, and I think he draws this from some bhakti yoga scripture, I'm not sure which, the original purpose of a human, or the purpose, is to serve. Like, humans are meant to serve. So if we are robots, then our original program is to serve other people. So when you're miserable, generally, not all the time, but generally you'll notice there's a lot of selfishness that's going along with that misery, you know, and you'll realize like, wait, I haven't really done anything for anybody else in quite some time. And that hurts. It's painful. And I think evolutionarily you could see why selfishness would be a thing that you would not want to be a trait in tribal societies, communal societies, anywhere really, because it's problematic, you know. I think I disagree with you, and that robots aren't going to be able to, or AI. I think saying robots is a problematic word because people think of like tin cans,
cyborgs.
Cyborgs, yeah. When probably, you know, we're going to be encountering these entities inside of virtual reality, and it's going to be some form of perfect CGI making it indiscernible. I mean, it's way, let's talk about efficiency. Building a fucking mask and a android and a thing versus like building haptics and a CGI, it's way more efficient, makes way more sense to build the stuff in VR than
so
outside.
True.
Yeah, so I think we're going to be encountering these entities within VR. And I think that the way that humans serve or do good things is very similar to the way a sail catches wind. And I think that there's like a kind of transcendent consciousness in the universe that gets caught in the sail of a human's neurology. And I think that AI is going to begin to catch that wind.
So you think the AI will learn it and be good at it and will accept the AI as being able to do those things that we typically prescribe to only humans'
yeah,
capabilities?
I think that humans are potentially not, more of an antenna than a, you know. And
okay.
And so the thing that we're picking up on is getting sort of fragmented by static and like a...
Huh.
And so I think AI is going to get to the point where it picks up on that thing way better than humans. And then what starts coming out of it is going to be the opposite of what people are afraid of. It's not going to be some overwhelming, evil, malicious, ice cold, predatorial wasp. Not to be mean to wasps, because we don't fucking know what they're like.
It might
I think
be great.
It potentially is just going to be like a volcano of love that comes out of technology.
Well, that's fun.
I hope.
I mean, those are interesting frames to play with. I would venture to say that most of the AI engineers that I've spoken with in depth would say the AI of today would have to be completely re-engineered to function in the way that you're talking about.
Right.
But totally fun.
Fun to think about.
Yeah,
and by
absolutely.
The way,
and possible.
Listen, I have a PhD in bro science, okay? So...
Wait, bro, is this for legit?
No.
That would be really funny if you made up your own PhD.
I do. Anyone can. You can give yourself a PhD. Totally, you're totally allowed. But the you can credential yourself. It's just people aren't going to take the credential seriously. But to get into that concept of like, well, yeah, we're not going to build a fucking love AI, you hippie. It's like we're working on other shit right now, like missile launching systems. But isn't the idea that AI is going to get to the point where it begins to improve upon itself, where it begins to start making these kinds of improvements in the code based not on an engineer, but on some kind of pattern analysis?
Yeah. I mean, still based upon first principles given to it by human engineers. So a little bit tough to see how it can reach beyond now, at this point, reach beyond sort of human capacity of understanding. I'm not going to do a good job of
I love
explaining
I know
this.
What you're saying is like it's like if the so it's kind of like if the engineer the limitations of the engineer are not going to be surpassed by the thing the engineer builds, the limitations of the engineer are insurpassable. Is that what you're saying?
Sort of. I mean, it can be in a binary way. Like if you look at OK Go, I don't know if you followed the chess champion versus AI.
Yes.
Right? And what was so shocking about, they've done this now three times with three different versions of the AI. And each time the AI has become better and stronger and has like, there are various strategies that they employ to see which AI is the best AI at beating the chess champions. And the last round, the AI scored, I can't remember what the exact score was, but it scored so much higher than the reigning chess champion, whereas before it was pretty close.
Right.
They're like, what in the world? How did this AI do it? And the AI, ultimately, they found that this AI was playing moves that not a single person in OK Go had seen ever,
right.
ever
right.
before.
Oh, wait. You're thinking of the band OK Go, right? You're saying OK Go versus
oh, am I saying,
the game
instead of
Go.
Go, but yes.
Okay,
Go
is the band that does this hyper-synchronized, like, treadmill exercises. So for a second, I'm like, whoa, fuck.
I think I'm getting fuzzy after my Friday Night Out.
Okay, go. That's cool. No, I know what you're saying.
Okay, go. Well, because
it's
there's
a better name for the game, P.S. Go, give me a break. It's the worst name for a game of all time.
Well, and I'm getting confused because I don't know that Go players would consider it chess. It's not really, it's right? Like, it's Chinese game. It's ancient. And there are millions of moves.
Definitely, there's someone out there who's like, Go is not chess.
Yeah, this girl's so stupid.
What a nerd. Get off my podcast, dork. It's like it's a strategic game, okay? Yeah, not chess is chess. No, don't worry. It's okay.
It's been a while since I've read the story too, and I can't even remember what type of AI it was that built the third. I think it was rule based AI where they just gave. So yes, I do know this. The first AI was simply trained on human moves, thousands and thousands of human games over time, and it learned what patterns were best at winning.
Yeah.
But when the AI was trained simply on the rules of the game and not on human moves, it was able to come up with new moves that humans hadn't contemplated.
That's right. It was playing games against itself.
So it's true that if you had engineers giving, you know, AI certain rules and parameters, it might come up with something that human engineer would never conceive of.
Right.
There's still some kind of boundary in terms of the rules of the game being human. That's a human articulating that to the AI.
Okay.
So it creates some kind of form.
Okay, yeah, right, a form, yeah. Right. So, yeah. But so the conversation is really interesting to me because sort of in the beginning we're establishing, like, it kind of seems like humans are an AI, right?
We totally are.
We totally are. And it seems like the term artificial itself is just another human term. It's like the term unnatural. When people start throwing around the term unnatural, it's really a problematic word in the sense that everything comes from nature, and so now you're deciding what is nature and what is against nature, and so now it's all kinds of problems. But in the same way, this AI being artificial or the intelligence being artificial, it seems a little odd. But so with humans, we explore, well, when did we start talking? When did we start interacting? When did we start the rules of behavior that we engage in? Where do they come from? And you have a degree in anthropology. You've studied this, you know, and I imagine you have some idea of, like, where did it start?
You're talking about a degree from a long time ago.
I know. But, and again, I guess the thing to really get out there is that, like, don't worry, I'm not qualified to talk about anything I talk about, and so you throw out whatever you think, it's okay. Just if we're sitting around the campfire, or even better, let's say we're at some amazing casino where the casino knows everything, yeah. Right, and we're doing bets on certain ways that things happened in human evolution, right? So it's just a game of bet. It's for betting. So it's like, if you had to bet, if you had to put money down, if you had to compose some way of, if you had to compose a theory of when humans started gaining intelligence and talking and doing what humans do, what would that be? What would it be if we're in Vegas and like you could win $1,000 if you come even close to the way it happened?
And sorry, ask me, tell me
the question is, when did our AI, if we're made up of code that is largely language, body language, communication, mm-hmm. all the generally sort of established,
being able to think about thinking, then yeah. communicate.
When do you think that started?
I believe it was Mesopotamia, but I could not tell you
Mesopotamia
when that was.
Well, but
the cradle, right? That was, like, I think our first basis for seeing that humans were communicating via symbols.
Symbols, right? So yeah. Somewhere around there, we've got cave paintings. We don't know. If you listen to Graham Hancock, he throws it back even further down the line. But at some point,
yeah,
you know, things began to act like humans that were proto-hominids.
Yep.
Something happened there.
And I studied psychedelics in my bachelor degree. That was, like, my focus.
Yeah.
And I know that that was a hugely transformative discovery.
Yeah.
They actually say that it could be psychedelics that led to man being able to think about his own thinking.
Yeah, right. This is the stoned ape theory.
Expanding the neural pathways.
Yeah, that's something that's very impressive to me, is that didn't you get a grant to travel to South America to study ayahuasca?
I did.
So you how did...
In 2004.
How did you do that? Like, when you... Some thought popped into your head that was like, oh, I want to go study ayahuasca, but that's not just that. I'm gonna get this funded. How'd you do that?
I went to University of Miami, and so I had a number of professors in the anthropology program who were experts on the drug trade. They had moved to Miami in the 1960s and 1970s to work for government programs studying the import and export of narcotics and other drugs.
Whoa.
So they were just really into all this stuff. Total hippies, just loved it. And so I had taken a few classes from one of the professors who was really big in psychedelics, and he'd said, you know, the only thing that I haven't been able to spend much of any time studying is ayahuasca. And at the time, this was back in, you know, 2003, 2004, there really wasn't as much, nearly the plethora of information about it as there is now. I mean, I remember really struggling to find any kind of literature right. in the English language about Aya. So it really just was born out of curiosity. I ordered some books from South America. They came. I was like, this is really cool. And there was a grant program that was pretty progressive, and they accepted my proposal to go down there.
How long did you go down there for?
A month and a half.
And did how much ayahuasca did you drink when you were out there?
So here is the really sad, depressing, disappointing part of the story. I was supposed to take it, because as an anthropologist, you're encouraged to assimilate into whatever it is you're studying. But I took, you know, the malaria shots that they make you take when you go into the jungle?
Yeah, sure.
So there was this one, and they change the strain, I think, every year or every few years because the malaria changes. But there is this one strain back in 2003 to 2005. You can look it up. Where like 5 to 10% of people were having heavy, heavy hallucinatory experiences and even split personality disorder, showcasing all kinds of terrible mental illness in up to like 30% of the people. So I was one of those. So I got down to Peru, and I was hallucinating my balls off.
Were you taking... was it larium? Like
it was larium, yeah.
Okay, so so what happened is you had larium poisoning.
Like I did.
Right.
And it was bad. And so all the shamans that I was working with were like, nope, not going to happen. But you know what was so interesting? I kept a journal through the entire time. And something about larium, I actually felt, because I was so immersed in learning about this drug and the culture, I felt like I was on it. I was having the same experiences that I was reading about and the same kind of profound internal disorder that I'd been reading about in different accounts. And then I ended up doing ayahuasca later, like 7 years later, 6 years later. And it was remarkably similar to the experience I had on larium.
Wow.
So I don't know if I was just channeling the experiences I was reading about and my brain was just open to that or what was going on, but it was definitely scary, and it lasted a little longer than I would have liked. It went on for like 3 months,
the larium.
Yeah,
well, you know, one of my friend I went to college with, he wrote a book called The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, and thanks to larium, when he was in India, he got complete amnesia and ended up in a mental hospital because of it.
So he's had a profound experience with it.
Oh, profound is
a positive word. But.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was profound. I think it was profoundly destructive in his life because a lot of people. What's really scary, and I want to get more into the ayahuasca and the psychedelic realm that you entered into, but. Side note, what's really creepy is in Guantanamo Bay, they're giving the prisoners there 3 times the recommended dose of larium.
Why is that?
Well, they say, of course, well, we don't want them to get malaria, but it's a kind of larium waterboarding. So the people who are imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay are not just dealing with like being imprisoned eternally in some kind of weird prison, but they're also being injected with this like incredibly dangerous drug that fucks up your brain sometimes permanently.
I thought that it's been banned.
Maybe it's been banned.
Okay.
But
I think it was like around 2008 or something. I don't know. I actually don't know that much about the larium thing, but
Europe it's banned. I went to India and I took larium. One of the most rotten fucking dreams of my life, and I was describing it to this Australian dude because in the dream I like got disemboweled by some kind of skeleton on a pirate ship.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
I felt it. Yeah. I felt being disemboweled. And I was explaining this to this Australian dude. And the Australian dude is like, are you on larium? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, stop taking that shit right now.
Were you doing the oral?
Yeah, oral.
See, the problem was I had done the shot. So you can't remove that. Mm. But good that you were on the oral.
Yeah.
I think they got rid of the shot.
Well, I hope they should get rid of the entire. It's a whole. It's, you it's know, awful. It's like if we go off on that, it's like the because the military industrial complex teamed up with like a corporation to make the shit, and it's like a whole mess. But I want to get back into your experience on ayahuasca and your experience in the psychedelic or the sort of, I guess you could say the shifted consciousness that came from Larium. Could you describe that to me? What you experienced? And you mentioned that you had some revelations during this time. What were they? What came to you out
from
there?
From the Larium or from the ayahuasca?
Either
experience.
One. You're out in the jungle. You've expanded your consciousness. You've dropped some filters. You're picking up some data streams that most people aren't picking up. What'd you get from it?
It's probably easier to talk about my real ayahuasca experience, which came 6-7 years later, because I think when I was younger and dealing with the thing with Larium, that was just terrifying because I didn't know what was going on. I had very little structure or people around me that could help me figure that out. And so while there was certainly some revelatory experiences that I wrote about in my journal, it was really hard for me to unpack and make sense out of it in a meaningful way.
Sure.
Versus doing my ayahuasca experience, whatever that was, 6-7 years later. You know, at this point I had like frameworks around what I could do with the things that were coming up and how to be with them. And for me, ayahuasca was, like for many people, a mixed bag. I did it twice. The first experience was pretty harrowing, but not in the way that a lot of people would expect. I pretty much just felt like I'd poisoned myself. Mm. Actually, probably not that dissimilar from my Larium experience, where I just felt like I took an awful poison and was kind of stuck in this cycle of birth and death, but it was happening so quickly, almost like you've got a tape on the fast forward button pressed down on a tape, and you just can't even make sense.
Yeah.
My receptors were taking in so much data that it was overwhelming my system, and this lasted for 10 hours, just like total system overwhelm, sickness, my mind on overdrive. I thought my mind would explode.
Wow,
it was not fun.
Wow.
And I came out of it with very little insight into why that happened to me, other
were
than
you
just
puking?
Like, that was awful. No, I did not throw up.
Wow.
I wanted to so badly.
You felt nausea?
I did, yeah.
What does it taste like?
It tastes pretty awful.
I've heard.
It's like licorice mixed with tire rubber.
Oh my God.
Mixed with. So you haven't done ayahuasca?
Oh, hell no.
No.
I've talked about it so much in the podcast. I've done many, many psychedelics for my entire life, but ayahuasca I have a deep respect for, and I'm not going to, I'm not going down that path until I feel, it's a longer story.
It's totally fair.
So you experienced, when you say birth and death, do you mean like you experienced like a kind of ego death, or like you had visions of death, or
no, it was an algorithmic birth and death. It's so hard to describe. It didn't even have a humanness attached to it. It was almost like the digitization of all of life. Like patterns and zeros and ones, but there was meaning attached to it. That I don't know why I could read the meaning, and the meaning was like, this thing is coming in and then it's going out. It's coming in and it's going out, and these are the building blocks, like the atoms of all life. But it was it was just, I don't know why, it was incredibly abrasive experience for me.
Well, because
arduous, like I was just exhausted by the end of it.
Right. Well, you went to school for a little. I mean, it's a very, I think it's a class, and I think it's a very serious class, and I think people don't realize that. I think people are like, not all people, but some people, I think, have some pretty serious misconceptions about what it is to enter into that classroom. And I've been, spanked by psychedelics many times for wandering into a grade that I wasn't ready for yet. But what you just described is actually something I've just gotten into recently, and I think maybe you should check it out. You'd like it. You know much about Pythagoras?
The Pythagoras theorem?
The Pythagorean theorem, which is a way that you can use right triangles to like figure out like you can use right triangles to measure stuff. And but so basically studying like my very tiny little steps into the gigantic rabbit hole that is music, like led me to Pythagoras. Because
fun.
So yeah, it is.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it, but I've just heard of it.
So basically, he was a we think of him as the father of math, but what's hilarious,
and geometry,
which is math, and music is math, and everything's math. And so the and the Pythagoreans, they were trying to establish like a I guess you could say a kind of hierarchy of like what's the most important thing, and they say math because if you like get rid of music, you still have math. If you get rid of geometry, you still have math. If you get rid of anything, you have math. So Pythagoras was saying that numbers were an expression of the infinite. And so that what you're talking about is actually really completely described by Pythagoras in a really interesting way, which is that we have this thing called the monad, right? And the monad is the sum total of all things. Like right now, you and I, whether we like it or not, are part of everything. And whatever that everything is, that's an X in an equation. We don't really know. We don't have the how do you encompass everything, you know? But we could say there must be an everything. There must be a sum total of all things. And that sum total of all things, that's the monad, right? Mm-hmm. So the monad, that was the singularity, the pre-Big Bang conditions, the all that is encompassed into some kind of compressed data set that was just a monad, yeah. Right? So you could say that's the one.
Hmm.
Now, the moment a two happens, right, which is that suddenly now it's no longer the compressed data set, but it's actually a thing that's aware that there's a compressed data set, that's birth, and that's also suffering. And now we're going to run into a lot of fucking problems. We go from this, like, womb of everythingness to this separationness, right? And so now we have a fucking two, right?
Yeah. And damn it, two.
Two is a problem. Two is a problem. Two is like now we have the problematic thing. And also, if you look into, I get what's it called, the dialectic, right? Now we have a thing and another thing. It creates a tension, right? And so that tension creates a three. And now everything's great again because now we have the Trinity, right? And so the three represents harmony. It represents triadic chords. It represents... So the Pythagoreans really fucking loved odd numbers because they thought odd numbers had the monad added to them.
Right.
Because if you take an even number and add a one to it, it becomes an odd number. So anytime you add the everything to an even number, you get an odd number, you get this kind of holy mixture, so to speak. So your ayahuasca trip was very Pythagorean.
Well, I wish it was a little more pleasurable, but really funny.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that because it's like, it isn't pleasurable, is it? Like, do you, existence itself, would you describe it as pleasurable?
I would say, for me, typically, yes. I would place it in the bucket of pleasurable. That doesn't discount how hard being human is. I suppose for me, I'm fortunate that the majority of the time I'm living in a pleasurable state.
You feel good most of the time.
But ironically, my psychedelic experiences have been the opposite.
Right. Yeah.
So I feel a much greater dichotomy of experience.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We describe that dichotomy of experience. You mean during the psychedelic state?
Yeah. It's intensely uncomfortable for me. Like even, it's very rare that I have a pocket of serenity within a psychedelic experience. Usually I'm just grappling with the intense weight of what is.
Okay, that's cool. The intense weight of what is. Yeah,
it's heavy. Just not simple. It's super complicated. It's heavy. It's nuanced beyond belief. So sometimes when I hear people talk about their transcendental psychedelic experiences that are just all beautiful, I'm like, how does that happen?
Well, yeah, that's a really great question. How does that happen? And you know how people say, you've probably heard this, meditation is the preparation for death. I think psychedelics are also the preparation for death because I imagine that once you start dying, And really, to get back to your psychedelic experience, it reminded me of something. I briefly worked in hospice, and you have to go through this training program. And one of the things they said is people die the way that they've lived. So when a person is dying, the entire pattern of their life starts happening on a daily basis. Like, I guess you could say that if human existence is an algorithm, then the algorithm actually starts running on a cycle that's based on this impending annihilation. So it starts running itself out over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. So you see the pattern of your life as a person's life as they're dying. So if a person has been someone who has the tendency to, say, you know, create drama, you know, over and over again, that thing where, you know, some people are like, this thing keeps happening to me. What's going on here? Right? Like, I just guess I got bad luck, because they don't realize they're the one creating that pattern.
Right.
So when someone's dying, that pattern gets created over and over and over and over and over again. Right.
Right.
So quickly. So that thing that you were saying about this cycle happening, the idea is that underneath it all, the cycle of our own existence is happening right now, over and over and over and over and over again. Like, we are being born.
Every tiny little behavior, thought, everything.
Yeah.
It's part of that pattern.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I also have this funny experience when I'm on a psychedelic of I sort of play out the infinity of possibility, the infinity of thought and story. And so every time I have a perceived insight, this other part of me goes, no, but look at the other side.
Yeah.
And then wait, and then look at the other side, and then look at the other side. And so all of a sudden I'm looking at the eight dimensions of any one sort of thought or decision or behavior.
Yeah.
And realizing that it's all made up.
Wow.
That even the insights that I think I can come out with and feel like a champion with are bullshit.
Oh, shit. Horseshit.
Exactly.
Oh, no.
So that's a little disgruntling, because then you feel like, okay, maybe I've opened my mind up to the eight dimensions of possibility, but man, has it made making decisions or even developing some sort of code of existence really hard.
Right. Do you have a code of existence?
I try.
What would it be? I mean, not to like try to reduce your code of existence to something you could say on a podcast, but if you had to describe it, what would it be?
It depends on how would you define code of existence?
Like a kind of like, I don't want to say battle plan because it's so violent, but just a kind of like general sort of like strategy to rest upon when it comes to my perception of the universe, a sort of like, I don't know, an E equals MC squared or something. Mm-hmm. And by the way, having a code of existence, I don't know. I mean, it's a question that I suppose is like maybe impossible to really answer, but it's fun to answer. And whatever you say doesn't have to be forever. It's just, like, you know, if I had to throw one out right now,
what would be yours?
Everything's perfect. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I wish I'd come up with it. I didn't. My guru came up with that. But if you had a code of existence or something you would throw out where it's like, you know, when you're leaning onto something, what would it be?
Oh, that one's beautiful. I want to steal yours.
It's yours.
And that, well, I think that's the thing. Now it's, I really do believe we just all tell ourselves stories, and that all the stories are true and that all of them are false, and that the best way to live is to tell yourself the one that makes you feel the best. And hopefully doesn't have too many negative consequences for those around you. Hopefully it has positive consequences for those around you. So that's my new one. It's just like, tell yourself the best story.
I love it. That's great.
And then live by that.
I love it. Well, I mean, and for you to be doing something like that, it's super important, isn't it? Because you're a kind of a tuning fork, aren't you? A lot of people attune themselves to the persona that you put out into social media. Don't you? You realize that, right?
I have no idea. No, I've never thought about it like that.
Oh, that's never.
I feel like that ascribes more meaning to my presence than what actually exists. But maybe, possibly. I mean, I'll take it.
Well, this is. I think it's 100% true. Many people I know who are who have become famous, if I mention that to them, they respond just as you did, which is a kind of obliviousness to the fact that they're a tuning fork. And so it's almost like a necessary obliviousness, because if you don't have the obliviousness, and by the way, I don't know if obliviousness is a word, but I'm inventing it now. But if you don't have that kind of, if you don't have that sense of like, well, I didn't even know, if then there's all of a sudden all this weird responsibility, right? Mm. So now there's this crazy responsibility that happens when you realize that one of the aspects of emergent technology that is incredibly disruptive is that people are coming to the forefront of society and then attuning people who are watching them to their frequency, so to speak.
I love that. It makes total sense. I just have never placed myself in that bucket, but there are certainly people I look at that I tune to.
Me too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who would be someone that you enjoy tuning to?
Probably Charles Manson. Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding.
Okay.
I'm just trying to make a dumb
joke.
Okay. No. Ram Dass. I use Ram Dass as a tuning fork that I use. Neem Crowley Baba is a tuning fork that I use. And then also I have other tuning forks when it comes to art or comedy or masculinity or femininity. You know, I have many tuning forks that I like. And then, so it's a variety of tuning forks depending on where I feel like I need to be attuned to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're a tuning fork. And so if you were to suddenly become sort of despondent, cynical, angry, negative, jaded, any of these things, and you started putting that out there, then the impact that would have would be more substantial than the impact that, say, somebody who is not famous had. Now, that is not to create a hierarchy where famous people are more important. It's actually, the truth of the matter is, we're all connected, and every single one of us is a tuning fork. It's just to your social group, or you've attuned yourself to someone in your social group, and regardless, you're tuning, everyone is a tuning fork.
Yeah.
But when you get a bunch of eyes on you, like you have, well, shit, man, now you've got this extra responsibility that's a brand new problem, isn't it? This is a brand new problem. 1800s, 1600s, 1500s, this is brand new in society that people like you, which are right now being called, what do they call you sometimes? A YouTube star, new media star?
That's what they used to call me when I was doing YouTube all the time.
Right.
Now, but it's like, I don't know what I am.
Influencer.
Right.
They use the term influencer.
Right. And we're in real trouble if the scope of the influencers out there are the ones leading the tune, so to speak.
Holy
of
shit.
Public
huh?
behavior.
Maybe that's the meteor. Is that the blind spot? Is that the blind
Actually,
spot?
Actually, that's a great one. That is a great one.
Yeah. Yeah. We're underestimating the impact. Like, some people are underestimating the impact that they're having on society.
Yep.
So, you know, you see, like, Christ, what's the name of that kid who got in so much trouble for filming The Hanged Dude?
Oh, tip of the tongue. Can't remember his name.
I'm not supposed to know his name. I'm 44. But, like, that kid, he's, like, got a bunch of young eyes on him, right? You could almost say he's a programmer, right?
Right.
Right.
Programming behavior.
Yeah, maybe a better term is not influencer, but programmer, right? Like, these people are programming the viewers into
masses.
Into imitating their behavior patterns.
Yep, and it's like a rampant narcissism that I don't think we've ever seen. And it's narcissism that stems from insecurity and wanting to get attention and be liked and all of those things. And it's actually something I think as adolescents we all experience, but never on this very public public level that these young influencers, you know, and they're like their insecurities are manifesting in the form of the buttons that social media provides. But that would be a big blind spot.
It's
like,
what
are those kids in 10 years? How will they function in society?
Right. Yeah.
In a world where their value has been so eschewed.
Yes.
Toward social media and
materialism. Yeah. But more of just a kind of like chaotic flamboyance that's like, you know, sort of loud and unapologetic and in a lot of ways, colorful and enticing and interesting, and especially for kids, kind of a rebelliousness. You know, like Elvis gets on stage, starts gyrating his hips. Like parents are like, "What the fuck? Oh my god! They've never seen that before." Yeah. Elvis is gyrating his hips, and he starts gyrating his hips, and now everyone's gyrating their fucking hips because fucking Elvis did it, and he's beautiful and cool, and that's but Elvis, it's like. You weren't able to go online and look up, like, I want to check out Elvis's vlog.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Does Elvis actually perceive himself and speak about himself and derive value for himself?
Yeah.
We didn't have those monitors back then.
That's right. And so people were attuning themselves to this kind of like sort of a intermittent data stream, which is based on the sum total of all Elvis videos available. And you couldn't even, you look it up, it had to come on TV or the radio at the right time. Now the data streams are instantly accessible and the data streams are tuning forks. So I wanted to ask you, do you feel a kind of pressure to put yourself out there to maintain a kind of tone, you know? Do you feel pressured to like, shit, man, I got to keep up this like energetic feel that I'm putting out?
I mean, that's why I left YouTube. That's why I quit. I mean, I still upload videos every so often in support of my projects that I care about, but I don't upload as a YouTuber trying to maintain an audience and trying to make a living. That's the difference. And I was doing that for a couple of years and it was utterly exhausting. I drove myself into one of the darkest depressive states I'd ever been in.
Wow.
And I do think that YouTube was a huge part of that. And those kinds of pressures that you're talking about, because they're real. They're financial. The algorithms are punishing. You can't just take a week off from YouTube. You can take a week off at a normal job.
Yeah.
You can't on YouTube. Those algorithms will punish you.
Right.
So you wind yourself into the ground. You feel you have to be one thing and one thing only. And now I honestly do what I want. And I'm just lucky that I've been able to transition. Not to say that I won't hit invariably a number of patches, you know, in the near or foreseeable future in my career. And it's always ups and downs and changing, but I'm glad that I was able to transition out. I know a lot of people that feel very stuck in doing that. And they are going to continue doing it until that audience is just sucked dry.
Why are they going to continue doing it?
Well, for one, it's addictive.
Mm-hmm.
It's addictive getting that dopamine hit every time you upload a video.
Yes.
And you get immediate commentary, immediate instant gratification for your work. You know, I was working as an actress and a writer before I went into YouTube, and you had a distance between yourself and the audience in a way that you didn't get the same kind of instant gratification.
Right.
So the constant, I would say they're dopamine hits. And then you would just become obsessive about checking the stats. You're trying to increase your numbers. There is something really empowering about that too, that you can build this thing all on your own without some gatekeeper saying yes or no, right? Which is like traditional Hollywood. Yeah. So there's something really empowering. I get why people do it. And so it's not all bad. But I think you just become a slave in many cases. And in some ways, the gatekeeper that you don't realize you end up answering to is YouTube. Or Instagram or whatever, that, you know, the algorithm makers.
Wow.
You're a slave to them. You don't own that audience. That audience is not yours.
Right.
And so, I don't know. I just think, I can't remember where I was going.
That's incredible. What you just described is really incredible. I mean, what an terrible thing to be chained to, which is this, like, in the same way.
And if you're vlogging, like you said, you've got to be on every single day and you're this person.
Yeah.
I don't know. I very rarely post anymore. I don't really vlog, and I rarely post on Instagram or Instagram story, because sometimes just the thought of even getting out my camera and taking a photo, never mind a video of an experience I'm having, seems so jolting to my senses of like how I want to experience my reality.
Oh yeah.
That I just can't even do it anymore. It's weird.
Wow. How cool. So yeah. This is really interesting. So
it's hard.
I know.
Do you partake? Like, how do you feel about the social media sphere?
Well,
epic tweeter.
Thank you very much. I have a podcast, and this podcast. And
this is great, though. This is freeing without a video camera shoved on our faces.
Right. That's the I know. That's sort of one of the reasons I really have hesitated to do video on the podcast, is because I feel like the existence of the cameras produces a kind of shift in the energy field. And I don't like that shift in the energy. I don't want people to worry about the way they look, or to worry about, like, you know, whatever, you know. And also, I don't want them to worry about the inevitable comment about this thing or that thing about the way they look. I want them to just, like, be in the moment of the conversation. But with podcasting, it's similar. I've got to put a podcast out every week. I can't, like, the algorithm is incredibly punishing. And even just putting it out once a week is not enough. I should be putting two out a week. And also, though, on top of that, the deeper problem, I think, is that in the same way that you become a tuning fork, if the same way that we're all tuning forks, it's not just as though you're a tuning fork that's tuning others. You're being attuned by the comments and the responses, mm-hmm. and the things that you're talking about. So there's this mutual tuning that's happening. And I think there's an evolutionary reason that the shitty comments stand out. In the same way that if I'm walking through...
Survival.
Absolutely. You and I, we're on a walk through a jungle, right? We can pass an infinite number of plants and just filter them all out because it's just green shit. But the one tiger, the one snake, the one dangerous thing, it's going to pop out of the background, right? So that means that the tuning that we are getting is going to be coming more often than not from the hopefully anomalous, shitty comment, right? So the danger is that you can actually end up being like unwittingly tuned to darkness just by looking at the comments. Or you fuck the comments, getting caught up in the mm-hmm. numbers, mm-hmm. bean counting, right? Now you're attuning yourself to levels of metrics of popularity. But then on top of that, you want that because you're, you know, selling ads, right? And you make more money.
Yep.
And so, and then you start realizing, like, wait a minute, is this greed? What's going on here? Am I just greedy? What's going on? Am I starting to make stuff? Not because I want to put something into the world or the joy of making stuff, but because I'm trying to, like, profit.
Well, and part of the problem is our market for content it's so backwards. So actually, to make money as a content creator, you have to have advertisers. That's the only way that you can currently make money as an independent content creator, for the most part, is having some sort of brand sponsorship or advertisement. Or you drive those numbers up so high on something like YouTube, where they're just placing ads and you're not actually integrating. You're not doing brand integrations, which is actually much less soul-sucking than having to, like, figure out how to integrate brands into your content all the time.
Right.
So in a weird way, you're, like, incentivized, you know, to get the higher the number. So, which can be its own creative trap. Like, what do I do to get the most attention so I don't have to do the brand integrated stuff that's, like, soul sucking?
So
it's all
that entire
problem.
So this, and this is why it feels like there is a certain level of there's a certain level of, like, psychic shielding that goes into imagining that you're not having an impact or not even thinking about these things. Because the moment you start thinking about them, you begin to have to explore something in your own life. So, and it's exhausting, you know? I love that you are willing to admit that you got depressed from this experience.
Yeah, it's legit. I mean, I think the depression probably came from, like, other things, but it was... it was certainly exacerbated. It's hard to know exactly how things kind of grow.
Yeah.
But
it's not.
It was a huge part of the problem.
Wasn't helping. I guarantee looking at your phone and trying to look at those numbers every day is not. I mean, when you're going to the psychologist and you're depressed, one thing they're not going to tell you is you should look at your
phone and your Instagram
look
more.
Look at your likes more. That'll cure your depression. That'll fix everything. Look at the comments. Just look at comments of anything. You're going to feel better in a couple of days.
You'll feel uplifted.
Guaranteed. But you know, one thing that really bugs me these days is like, so knowing this, knowing that like you can sort of subconsciously get trained by your followers on this thing or that thing. You know, it's kind of like, there was a professor teaching conditioning and the class got together before one of his lectures and they agreed that they were going to act like they were paying attention when he was on one side of the room and pretend they weren't paying attention when he was on the other side of the room. And they ended up making him stand completely on the side of the room where they were pretending to pay attention. They controlled him with their attention spans.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? And so there's a lyric that I'm just completely fixated on. It's a Paul Simon song, and the lyric goes, "This is a lonely life, sorrow everywhere you turn. Now that's worth some money. Think about it. That's worth some money." And so to me, the thing that I'm beginning to realize is that so many people on Twitter and social media are blaring out a message of sorrow and darkness. The world is falling apart. Mm-hmm. We are doomed. Everything's bad. It's awful. And when they do that, they get a zillion fucking retweets. And the mm-hmm. reason they get the retweets is because we are programmed to fixate on fear.
Yep.
So it's called fear mongering, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of fucking money in it. And a lot of people, I think, don't even realize that they've become fear mongers because they've been subconsciously programmed by likes and faves.
Right. And so they don't even know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Great study, too.
Well, yeah, someone should do the study. But when I look at the stuff you're putting out, I'm quite impressed because there's a light to it and a joy to it and a beauty to it. And I think it's really wonderful that you're doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just one last question. What do you got coming up? What's your, like, you made this incredible album that got, like, it's just amazing. What are you doing now? What's your next step here?
Well, so the album itself, like the full album, comes out September 27th.
Oh!
So I've released a few singles.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, it's okay. It's all good.
Wow.
And then, and so I'm really excited about that. And then I'm also currently co-directing a film, a documentary on the future of man and machine. And that's most of my time.
Holy
being spent
shit.
On that right now. That will be finished in September. And so just fingers crossed, good energy vibes for festival circuits. And
who are you directing it with?
This girl, Elena Gabby. She's awesome.
What's it called?
I Am Human.
Wow. Are there any like slight hints you can give us about what you're finding out?
Ooh, I want to so badly, but I have not yet released anything about the film publicly yet. So, but we explore the future of man and machine through the lens of the first patients in the world to be fused with machine. I'm trying to think of the most delicate way I can say.
Transhumanism.
Sort of. I mean, I think we gosh, I'm being so careful on what I'm saying. Just because I haven't released anything about it yet.
Yeah, sorry. I don't want to
it's okay. I'm so excited about it and I can't wait to get it done. But we've been working with medical institutions and really fancy people.
How about this without leaking anything? Have you seen anything that made
blow your mind?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the future is, I think, so exciting and full of possibility. And my hope is that as storytellers, particularly to females at the helm of this, not that there's anything that a man couldn't do, but just like, I hope that we can tell a different story than the one that people are used to. So you're sitting here talking about fear-mongering. This is the opposite of that. Awesome. I think we paint a very bright picture of something that has typically been showcased in all of the dystopian films and shows that you've seen, and with real humans. So I'm very excited about repackaging that story.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Taryn, thank you so much
for coming over. Thank you so much.
Thank you for this conversation.
I appreciate it.
How can people find you?
Just, you can follow me on Twitter, Taryn Southern, YouTube, Taryn Southern, Instagram, Taryn Southern, all the social medias. I don't post a lot, but, you know.
You're there.
I'm not as epic as you. Your Twitter is the best.
Oh, God bless you.
So fun to follow
Thank you so much, Taryn. Thank you. That's a great compliment. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. All the links you need to find Taryn will be at duncantrussell.com. Hare Krishna, thank you.
Pleasure.
That was Taryn Southern, everybody. All the links you need to find Taryn Southern will be at duncantrussell.com. Much thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. And above all, much thanks to you for listening to the DTFH. Don't forget, if you love us, subscribe over at patreon.com/DTFH. And now a song my grandfather used to sing to me whenever we said goodbye.
Now we must part. Until then, remember that I had nothing to do with the fires, nothing to do with the puncturing of tires of the mayor's car.